your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there.
Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me, as almost always, the Alpha to my Omega, the living meat baby to my human methane electroreactor, it's Dan.
Good evening, Scott.
I thought you'd appreciate that, because I kind of just refer to myself as a big fart machine.
Yes.
And since we are going to be talking once again about Preacher, that means we're also joined by our favorite pucker face pal, the Eugene of the Bayou, Cade.
I got out of hell this time, guys. I got back. I know I kind of disappeared on there for it, but I'm back, everybody.
Well, actually, the fact that you're on this podcast, this is your hell. And we're just going to keep repeating this podcast over and over and over. So,
I think I'll behave. I think I'll manage.
I think you will. You just load up on, what was it Cassidy said? Was it meth and Red Bulls or cocaine and Red Bulls?
Yeah.
I
can't remember.
Well, I think we've got a whole lot to talk about with the season finale of Preacher. And, you know, and much like the episode and even the season itself, it kind of veers from some of the most memorable stuff I think any of us have seen on TV in some time, if not ever, to maybe some stuff that I'm suspecting might have left some of us shaking our heads a little bit. I don't know. So I'm thinking we'll just break this down into different parts, and we can just go over what was great, what was fundamentally flawed, whatever the fuck we want to talk about here. I mean, that's the way I'm going to go about it. So you guys ready to dig into this episode?
I'm ready.
That would be acceptable. Please proceed.
Well, let's get ready to start talking about Preacher.
I got the ball in ball blue. When I first started bowling, just a spare was great, and my score looked good at 108. And they said if I practiced, I could raise my game. So I practiced and I practiced, but I still bowl the same. I got the ball in ball blue.
Well, if we're going to start talking about this episode, and wait, what was the title of this episode? Call and... God, I forgot the title of the episode. What a great way to begin a podcast, by forgetting the title of the episode. Was it Call and Response?
Season 1 finale, that's what we call it.
Wow, I feel so lame.
Hold on 1 second. Yes, Call and Response is the name of the episode.
Okay. Well, that goes right off the bat. You know, we're not dealing with a lot of notes here, people, if I'm forgetting the title of the episode. So let's start off with that scene between Sheriff Root and Cassidy in the jail cell. Now, Dan, I didn't need to be podcasting with you last week to know that you're a pretty big fan of W. Earl Brown here. So I was really curious to hear what you thought about this scene, because I thought it was it was significant, and I had issues with it as well. So what did you think about it?
Well, you know, kind of based on what we were going on last week, where we kind of felt like there wasn't, they weren't really using the character well, it kind of felt like this, for me, it was the first part where, like, they were actually starting to use the character a little bit well, even though I thought that it might have been a bit of a leap for him, like, you know, believing in vampires. I don't know if they quite earned that, but it wasn't as bad as the, you know, Emily jumping the vampire last week.
Kate?
I'm going to agree with Dan. Well, it was interesting to see him, like, be more of a cop and display cop. How he can just say how he found all these references to Cassidy throughout all this stuff. I'm, like, not saying it's impossible, but I just don't see a small town having access to all these different criminal databases to where he could just, within a matter of time, find all this stuff out and then go, oh, yeah, I believe he's a vampire, like Dan said. It's a large jump that didn't really make sense. I didn't really see how it's even possible. It was interesting to hear the things about Cassidy and all that and Cassidy's reaction, but it didn't come off as realistic to me or true to the show.
Yeah, I was about to say realistic.
Yeah, I realized, boy,
this is not the right show to be.
Vampire? Yeah, realism can go out the window.
This is not the show to be applying rules of realism to.
It didn't seem truthful to the show is what I want to say. That's where I think.
Interesting. Okay. I kind of agree to a certain extent. I'm probably leaning more towards what Dan was talking about here. I mean, my feeling with the scene was, you know, if Root had been played this way all season, I think he would have been a truly great character all season. But we spent too much time with him either being, you know, just a degree or two away from being bumbling. I'm not saying he was, but he was darn close to it. Definitely ineffectual. If nothing else. And all of a sudden, now in this episode, he's sharp as a tack. And he's I thought the scene was acted great. I love, you know, and the way it was composed, whatever. But my issue with True is I didn't think this was the character I'd seen before. So it's like what Dan was saying about the way Emily changed. And it's funny, because we like what they became, but we didn't really believe that was earned from what they were before that. I might buy it a slightly more with the sheriff because he's been through more and his emotions have affected him as far as his missing son and when he thinks he actually killed the Seraphim or Archangel, I've heard her called now, which I prefer to Seraphim. So I can see there maybe being something more of a transformation with his character, but still there is the element of he made the deduction about him being a vampire and he was able to figure that out based on this file that detailed all these crimes that go back to the 1920s.
Huh. Yeah, I was thinking of the X-Files episode with Toombs, you know, where they're just like, you know, well, they're tracking his crimes over like all these decades and stuff and like all the work they had to do to like, you know, dig up stuff. And it's like, okay, there's probably, you know, there ain't too many Eugene Victor Toombs, but there's a lot of fucking Cassidys out there. So, you know, what's his first name?
Oh, God, have they ever even given us?
Yeah. Whatever it is. It's probably, you know, a pretty standard first name, so I'm sure, you know, there could have been that, but it wasn't, but, it was a good scene. It was fun.
Here's the thing. I don't care about the believability factor of how the sheriff got such a file. I'm just going to say it right there, because it's not just comic book, this is pulpy stuff. So I can't get caught up in that kind of a detail, because you start peeling that back, then there's any number of things you should start peeling away. Because it's a device for the scene. And there's nothing cooler in that scene other than later on than Cassidy just knowing what's coming because he sees the Manila folder. And he keeps saying the Manila. Because you realize, and what makes that genius and what works for the scene is this is probably not the first time Cassidy has had to deal with this. Because he knows what's coming. He's been in scenes where he's seen that folder before. Probably the other times he's been incarcerated. Now, I don't want to get hung up on how did they get this. It's kind of like how the fuck did that happen?
I wonder if the file maybe the angels might have had that file on him just when they were dealing with him, possibly. But it's the kind of thing where the sheriff was in their room, so maybe he found that there. It's possible.
Right. Again, my issues with the scene are bigger. It's like what you were saying about the Root character and how it didn't seem to be the character we'd seen before. And I tried to even come up with my own explanation for it. I'm not buying my own explanation up to its point. It works a little bit, but there still should have been some him trying to figure out what it was. I had a hard time believing he just figured out he's a vampire.
It kind of feels like there's a missing scene somewhere. Like, yeah.
I agree. In fact, and I read this somewhere this week after the finale, some people were feeling it was almost like they were missing an episode in between for certain details that happened here, and which is funny.
I can see that too.
Which is bizarre considering how much, I don't want to say how much time they wasted this season, but how much time they wasted this season, and then all of a sudden it feels like you're missing an episode. So maybe things were moving too slowly at one juncture, and now they just moved way too fast? I don't know. But my other problem with the scene is that, you know, the point of the scene is that Root is trying to find out what happened to his son. And first, Cassie is just not telling him anything or being very vague. And the longer the scene goes on, especially after he initially shoots him and then gives him the blood, and then he realizes he knows he's a vampire, which means this character is now already predisposed to believe the most insane things already, you know? The scene kind of loses something when the sheriff just loses his temper, shoots him a bunch of times, and just lets him go. Because didn't it seem just before that he was actually going to get an answer out of him?
Yeah, I thought Cassie was about to tell him what was going on.
And if we're seeing that, I'm thinking the cop who's used to dealing with, you know, people or at least even mild interrogations. I know it's a small town, but even interrogating kids about vandalism, maybe, I don't know, would have caught on to that. That just seemed like the scene felt like a great setup, and it didn't ultimately have a great payoff to it. So that was kind of my problem with it, if that makes any sense.
No, I would agree with you on that. Yeah. The scene falls flat at the end. It didn't have a progression to a point that made sense. It's just like, well, that just happened. I don't know why that just happened. Because like you said, you could see Cassidy was, it clearly reads he's about to tell him what happened. Yeah. And then he just does what he does. And it's like, well, I'm not sure what we were supposed to get from that scene.
Yeah, and I think this could be a bit of a problem that the show has from time to time. It happens, that problem I think happens more than once in this finale and also over the course of the season. So, I mean, I still like the show. And I get the feeling I might have sounded a bit more negative than I thought I did in our previous podcast based on some reactions that have been disclosed to me.
I thought the same thing.
But it's just, it's a show, it's got some really great characters, and you've got these great scenes that are set up really amazingly, but they don't always have that great follow-through. They don't finish well, necessarily. Dan, you know what it reminds me of? It almost reminds me of like a criticism I used to have at a certain point of Stephen King's career, where he'd have these great ideas for stories or books or giant books, and then he didn't have a really great way to finish them. And there was a bunch of books of his which are like, you know, oh, such a great book, and then, wait, that's the ending? You know, for me, it is like the biggest example of all time because it's such a great book for so much of it, and then the ending kind of like, what, really? That's your ending?
Oh, yeah, it's just like with all these, like, you know, movies and stuff, the superhero movies and whatever, just they can't come up with a good villain and just, like, get an awesome story and just tons of good cast, and for whatever reason, they'll cast an amazing fucking actor, and they just can't get the fucking villains right, other than, like, you know, Baron Zemo was cool, you know, there's been some other ones that have been Loki, of course, but it's just like that, we're just like, it should make sense, this is fucking, like, Lee Pace, and then just nothing is fucking happening here, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is, like, I find in this show's point, I'm far more critical about this show than just a show that is all around mediocre, because there are good points that I can contrast the bad points with. And if I can do that, that means I'm going to talk about that more. I just can't be, well, there's the good stuff and ignore the bad stuff because I have that contrast. And this show is one of those shows. There are characters and there are interactions that are really good. So when you see things that are flat, you're like, I have to talk about that because it's not holding up to what other parts of the show are.
Right.
Yeah, and right now, I mean, the show's kind of running a razor line where, you know, contrasting with a couple different AMC shows, I mean, it's like we're seeing, like, the good stuff that, like, Breaking Bad would do, but we're seeing the stupid stuff that Walking Dead would do, and it's like, we're not sure, but, you know, it's just the elements of that. But, you know, just like you said, with a show that feels like it's wasting time, if they can't take the time to set up these character scenes like that when you know they fucking had the time to do it, then there's something that isn't quite coming together there, so... I mean, I'm assuming that the show will hopefully improve, but I mean,
for some reason I'm very secure it's going to, and I think a large part of that is this season, as I understand it, 90-something% of the season would be considered backstory they had to come up with for the actual story of Preacher from the comic books. Most of what we've seen in these 10 episodes. Didn't happen in the comics. It's all happens before it. I think eventually what happens to this town, it happens within the first couple pages of the first story of Preacher, or something along those lines, from what I understand. So on one hand, you know, it's cool that the creators and the writers and, you know, Rogan and Goldberg and Catlin, all of them, you know, almost had a bit of free reign to create this backstory for them and everything else. But on the other hand, they didn't have that blueprint to really help guide them a little bit better, and thus maybe help keep it a little bit tighter and more true to the characters that are the reason they fell in love with these characters and wanted to make the TV show in the first place. You know, I mean, everything I've heard about, like, say, the Preacher character himself is that he's one, I mean, we curse in this podcast, he's one cool motherfucker, from what I understand from the comic books.
Yeah.
I don't think he becomes a cool motherfucker until maybe this episode. I think this is the first episode I really thought, oh, I think I see the Jesse Custer that people have been waiting for. It only took them, like, you know, almost 9.5 hours to get there, I think, you know, or something like that. But I wonder about that, and it's fortunate for the show that they already got a second season. Because now, whereas it felt a little bit static, because, you know, it's just him trying to preach in that town, whatever, they're going to be a road trip show. I love the idea of road trips. I love road trip movies. I love road trip stories. The very first script I ever wrote is a road trip story, because the story is literally always in motion. There's always something happening. There's always pushing forward. And you deal with new characters and new towns and new situations, you know, every episode or every few episodes. It's the one thing that a show like Walking Dead was never able to accomplish, because they always like, oh, we're just going to sit here for an entire season.
Yeah, it's like, oh, they're moving. This is where it's good. Let's bunker down for a season and a half. Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's when the show falls apart.
The only problem with them going to the road trip format, I guess, I don't know how else to refer to it, is that tends to be expensive. So it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that. Because you can't do a road trip show and still be shooting everything in, like, Albuquerque, unless maybe you're dressing everything up to look differently all the time, like, say, Lost did with Hawaii or other shows have done. I guess they could. But I'm very curious to see how they do that. Well, we jumped to the end of the show before we finished talking about almost any part of the show. So let's get back to one of the other major things of this episode I thought was definitely fodder for conversation and definitely interesting. The Jesse and Tulip stuff. So the very beginning of this episode, you know, Tulip tracks Jesse down to Donnie's house, who has apparently had some major religious conversion and is now helping Jesse, as is his wife, who is busy cooling her freshly spanked ass with a bag of frozen blueberries. And I had to pause that. I was like, wait, what is blueberries? Blueberries. But, you know, and we can certainly, whatever you guys want to say about that is fine. We can talk about that. But I think what's really key here, it's that flashback story that we finally have get completed. The entire bank heist. And we find out just what the deal was with Carlos. And, you know, and lastly, before I throw it to, I'll throw it to you, Cage, to lead off. The reminder that Jesse can be a pretty cold-blooded murderer, as well as the information about why Tulip really has a problem with Carlos. So what did you make of this, Cade?
The flashback was one of the better scenes, because you got the interaction between Jesse and Tulip and saw when they were in love and not like they are now, where Jesse's trying not to be that person, but Tulip wants that person. You saw them in the love, and you find out why she hates him so much. Not just because of, it was multiple things, not just because of what he did at the bank, but she clearly is blaming him for losing the baby. It clearly is on her mind as one of the reasons why she wants him, which also leads back to why I think she was so protective of the kids in the very first time we meet her, because I think that carries through. That's a carry through for her, that she lost her child, so she wants to protect these kids as much as possible. I'm inferring that, but it really would make sense that that would be how she would see it, because she lost her chance at a child. She wouldn't want someone else to lose their children. So that I think that was a very interesting thing there.
Yeah, I had the similar thought when I was when I watched that. I'm just like, oh, I bet you that would make some of the scenes earlier in the season really like have a little bit more significance. The glances that she was making and stuff to, you know, pointless ass Emily's kids and stuff.
Right.
I think it definitely paints the way she treats children and how she's reacted towards the kids a lot differently in that mindset once you see that's happened to her. And I would like to see those scenes again and see maybe if you can really sense it then. Once you know that knowledge, you can actually see that that's being played up in a little bit.
You're both absolutely – I don't know why that didn't occur to me, but you're both spot on. Because one of the things we've seen about that character, and now that you're saying it, and especially with Dan said about Emily's kids, you see that she does have a certain almost wanting maternal instinct that kicks in a few times. Like that's what gets her with the scene with Emily when she realizes that she's ruined. Is it Emily's kid's science project?
Her art project, yeah, her art little project? Sculpture.
I couldn't remember what it was. So, wow, good insight.
Yeah, she fixes the sculpture because she feels bad when she realizes it was her kid's and wasn't just like hers. That's when she immediately is like, she'll fix it. That's what I'm probably sure, but that was the thing that struck me the most in that scene.
And I don't know if we raved about her enough in our previous podcast because I actually never listened back to it for a second or third time, so I don't remember.
She was one of the bright spots for us.
Is it Ruth Nega? Is that her name?
Yeah, Ruth Nega.
She has been wonderful all season. I mean, I thought she was fantastic in the finale. I think all her scenes. I mean, she gets actually, to me, she got some of the biggest laughs in the episode, you know, just as much, if not more so, than Cassie, because Cassie is clearly there quite often for comic relief at times, but she had a couple ballsy, funny scenes that really made me laugh in this, as well as emotionally effective scenes as well. I thought she really brought the goods. I like her so much more on this than her character than when she was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., by the way.
Yeah.
It was kind of like the, you know, with this character in particular in this episode, it just seemed like the things that we like about the show, like, really worked well this episode. Like, they turned it up, you know, turned it up a notch, and then, you know, the things that we didn't like, you know, didn't work, obviously. But it just seemed to be, the, you know, doubling down on everything this week, and she definitely was kicking ass.
Right. Now, and here's the thing with all the Jesse and Tulip stuff, and then we should then mention, you know, once we get out of the flashback, you know, we do get to the scene where she reveals that she's got Carlos in the trunk of the car, and you get that whole scene where Jesse decides he's going to kill him after all, and Tulip actually stops him. You know, it's all about, it's the thought that counts kind of a scene, which works better than I would have expected that moment, too. I thought that scene actually did work really well, especially when you then go back to that flashback. Even if we don't actually see it, we realize that Jesse killed that security guard at the bank, and he didn't. And notice in that moment you see him, he doesn't look all that upset about it. He actually, if you go back and watch that flashback when they cut to him and he's clearly just shot him like moments earlier, there's a certain, I don't want to say he looks giddy, but he doesn't seem that bothered by what he's just done. So it's kind of showing that Jesse was kind of a bad guy, huh. You know. But we get this whole thing with them handing Carlos a tire iron and a gun. So I guess they want to make a quote unquote fair fight before they beat the fucking shit out of him. Is that essentially what happened there?
Yeah, that seems like what it was. Yeah.
So here's the thing, and this, at least they did a better job with all this than say like the Root Cassie thing, because, you know, I thought it, you know, unlike that thing, and quote-unquote ended well. I mean, it built to something. It built to a resolution. The characters reached a different state, you know, in their relationship and everything else. And the Carlos stuff, that's fine. I was cool with that, whatever, if that's the right way to put it. Here's my one problem, though. We just took a lot of time with this flashback story and this whole Jesse Tulip thing, which was great, but the problem is this episode was about a ticking bomb. We're waiting for God's arrival. They keep giving us that great little, you know, clock ticking thing throughout the episode, which was ridiculous but funny. They use it for actually a very amusing comic effect later on. I don't know if anyone picked up on that. I'm going to mention that in a few minutes. But it seemed like this was kind of a derailing tangent for that. And it seemed like, oh, we're going to step away from this, you know, you know, it's a, the fast moving thrust of the story to tell you this story now. And I kept wondering if there was a way that they could have figured out a way to work this in without it interrupting the flow of what the story was building to. So just from a pure storytelling perspective, I kind of had a problem with it. If that makes any sense to you guys, I don't know.
Yeah, it was very it was tangential. It didn't really line back up with the main story as much as it could have.
To me, it kind of felt like maybe they weren't sure they were going to get picked up, so they just kind of wanted to tie off the loose end in the finale, because this could have worked for a series finale if they ended up just doing a one-and-done season, so...
Okay, I'll go along with that. You know what it made me think of, actually, and then I'll move on to something else if you like. It was kind of almost a Tarantino-like thing here that he does from time to time, and sometimes it works, and sometimes I don't think it works, but we allow it because Tarantino's so incredibly self-indulgent. I don't know if you guys have seen The Hateful Eight, because he really does it big time there. It's the idea that he's telling this big story, and you know, it's and there's a certain tension level building, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm going to go here for a while, and we're going to get away from that, and we end up going away from it for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 17, it's Tarantino, it could be a half an hour, who the fuck knows, amount of time. And even if it's entertaining or fun, it's like, hey, but you know, you kind of punched yourself in the balls as far as the actual story you were telling, because you kind of lost the narrative thrust. You know, Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't fucking do that, you know?
So, oh, fuck no.
Then again, Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't take 2 hours and 50 minutes to tell a fucking story either. So, for some reason, I just felt like beating up on Tarantino for a second. Hey, so, fuck all that. Let's get to what I would think, I'm hoping, maybe you guys agree, don't know, what I felt was the true, what's the phrase, piece de resistance of this entire episode. God coming to Anvil. I just felt personally that there was so much to out and out love about this scene. I mean, the crazy look of it. You know, the fact that they dressed up this actor in the most cliched God look ever. You know, complete with that wig and beard that looked straight out of some sort of cheesy... like stage production or something.
It was so bad it was good.
Exactly. And you know, it harkens back to the way the series opened with that little outer space sequence. It looked so bad it was really good. I think they already set the stage for us just with that moment. Oh, by the way, I did take the time to look up who the actor was who was playing God or the God imposter, as we soon learn. It was the actor whose name is Mark Herlich. This dude.
I
know you know him.
Yeah.
Because he's been in a billion TV shows over the years. I mean, you name it, he's been in it. He was in Star Trek Voyager. He's in Seinfeld. Breaking Bad, The Leftovers, The Big
Bang. Oh, my
God.
Big
Bang
Theory
several
him up.
Times.
Yeah, I know.
You remember him from that Voyager episode?
Yeah. Wow.
But I'll just say, just for the people out there, especially people who have seen, you know, movies, probably his most... recognizable role or most significant role, probably the thing that the highlight of his resume, I'm going to point to the movie Election from I think it was like the late 90s. He's the schmucky teacher who thinks that he and Tracy Flick are in love. So that's kind of, that might still be his biggest role, definitely his biggest movie role for sure. So if anyone's who's seen Election out there, and if you haven't, oh my God, you need to see the movie Election. It's brilliant. But he's kind of the schmucky asshole friend of Matthew Broderick in there who pretty much blows up his whole life because he thinks he's in love with Reese Witherspoon's character. Anyway.
I really like this God thing, too. It reminded me of, like, it was like half God from Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and like half God from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Just the way he was framed. And, of course, like, both those things work for me. I actually like the first movie, I mean, for the most part. But, you know, just like felt like that, just like schlocky over the top, just funny. And then, of course, you know, but it was like over the top, but like didn't feel like over the top, you know, like it wasn't too much. It was just,
I think I kind of felt it was almost so gloriously over the top that I wasn't even thinking about it that way. And the Monty Python thing came to my mind right instantly. I love that you mentioned Star Trek V because, yeah, I could see that. Absolutely. You know what happened? Dan, you'd probably especially find this funny, Dan. When that scene first starts, and or at least when God first appears, I'm staring at the screen. I got closer to the screen because just for maybe 5 seconds or less there, because of where they filmed, the connections to a certain other show that we've talked about a lot on the other podcast, I went, oh my God, did they go and get Bob Odenkirk? Because this totally looks like something he would have done on the Mr. Show, whatever. And I had to like, no, that's not Bob Odenkirk. Damn it, that would have been so cool. But for that moment, I did think it could have been him. Although that probably would have given it away too fast that this was a fake. But
in the scene where Jesse arrives at the church in the trunk of the car, there's a shot where they turn the camera and they have a long shot of Donnie's wife, you know, kind of with the big mountain above it. That's on the east side of Albuquerque, Sandia Crest. So I'm just like, oh yeah, good shit. I mean, just because, you know, we've seen that same kind of angle, you know, Breaking Bad is a million times.
I wasn't even thinking that. I was just thinking when she went on that close up of her. When she opens the trunk of the car and you see the trunk open, it reminded me of the end of Breaking Bad when that trunk of that car opens and something else comes out. getting back to the, let's just call it the God scene, whatever. I did find out by watching like the talking preacher thing that came on after it, and then I read this somewhere else the next day as well, that what they did on the set was they actually had a suggestion box where crew members would put in questions to ask God. So the quest, like that first question we saw where the woman gets up, the girl gets up and says, why do bad things happen to good people, whatever, that was one of the suggested questions. Stuff like my favorite one, and this I've watched the finale twice, and when I hear this, it made me laugh out loud both times. When you hear someone yell, what did you do with the dinosaurs?
Yes.
And I just love it. Like, what did you do with them? Like, did you hide them somewhere? Did you put this? I love that. Also, the other thing that I found out from watching, again, the Talking Preacher thing, their favorite question that didn't make the cut for the show that someone had put into it was, what's the deal with mustard? Which really would have been a funny question to hear.
That would have been a good one.
I fucking hate mustard, so yeah, bring it on.
Like, if someone had stood up all serious in the church and went to go talk, ask the question, and that was the question that came out, you'd be rolling. You couldn't help but just laugh yourself about how funny that would be.
Yeah, it'd be funny on like a whole nother like, can you put my penis back on level? So.
Yeah.
How many times do they make fun of the poor guy with the dick being shot up?
Yeah.
It's like at least 3 times we get references to his dick.
Yeah,
being shot.
Just make some random comment about him.
Like even
he's just carrying it around.
Yeah, even when the preacher is trying to make the call happen, someone in the audience yells, "Why don't you shoot its dick off?" Yeah. I love that because that actually to kind of. Cop a phrase Cade used earlier that actually felt authentic to me. Like, yeah, I could see someone thinking they're really funny and yelling that in the crowd. Now, I have to admit, because again, I had no idea what was going on here, that when this whole scene was playing out, I was just like, holy shit, they're going for it. This show is crazy. You know, he just put the sun out and God's appearing and he looks like this, like something out of Monty Python or a Colbert episode from a few weeks ago. I don't know. But then when we get to the revelation that he's not God, which I think is genius in its own way, especially when you start rewinding back to what his answers were to these different people and you realize, you know, he's giving fairly vague, generic answers to everybody. You know, anyone could be saying this. It doesn't have to be quote unquote God, whatever. But how that whole scene plays out, it's like, it turns out that God is missing. They don't know where God is. And since this transmission, I guess, I don't know how else to refer to it, this video conference call is supposed to be coming straight from heaven, you realize that, you know, the angels and whatever, maybe this guy is one of those angels, I guess, no one knows where God is. I, again, never having read the comic book, so I didn't know about what their quest was or anything, that was kind of a huge occurrence, which surprised me, but kind of made me go, "Ooh, that's really interesting. That's something I didn't see coming." Did either of you have a sense of that, or what was your reaction to that being the big revelation in that scene? Revelation is not meant to be a pun, though it really works here.
I will say this is the one moment where, having actually know that bit about the story, like the basics of Preacher, that revelation wasn't a surprise to me. I knew that was coming, but playing up to it like it was still entertaining enough. Like, the minute I got to realize, like, when he popped, I'm like, that's not God. I'm waiting for what falls out here. So I get to see it in a different way because I knew where it was going to end up. So it was funnier even realizing, who is this person? Why are they letting him do this? How is that going to happen?
Yeah, I didn't know it was coming, and I enjoyed it, and it definitely, informs, like, the world that the show takes place in. But I kind of just appreciated it on a technical level. Like, we found it out in, like, kind of just a funny, ridiculous way instead of just a bunch of exposition by some, random yes. character that'll just disappear. So I just like when shows deliver, like, big information in just kind of like a organic way.
Exactly. I love that. I love it wasn't just someone telling us it, which would have been like if Fury and DeBlanc had known this already and this had been one of the many things they told him, like, that's kind of a huge thing. That we should have gotten that better. So I do love that they delivered that message this way. Now, here is I'm sorry. You about to say something before I go on further?
Oh, I was just going to say that it's really, I'm glad that we live in a world and, maybe people that are like the real life versions of boring ass fucking Emily wouldn't agree, but I'm glad that we live in a world where like a show like this can air on a fucking Sunday.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Bring it down.
By the way, I'm actually going to, I wouldn't say I'm going to defend her, but I don't feel Emily is boring ass anymore because she plays 96 Tears on the organ and everyone's just
stunned. Does.
And I was like, "Oh, I love you, Emily." I don't believe the character progression that happened a couple weeks ago, but I love your character now because you're actually smiling through this and playing this awesome classic tune from the 60s on the organ, which is played with an organ, so it works perfectly for the scene.
Was kind of nice that she was. I did notice she wasn't in the episode until 45 minutes, of including commercials in. So, I mean, that definitely helped in my opinion and make the episode stronger. Limiting our exposure to this character who's been kind of bland so far.
Okay, but my question about the scene or my issue with the scene, if it's an issue, I haven't decided. I'm kind of up in the air on this one. Is it okay that after this huge thing happens, that we get the big reveal that God is missing and these unseen people are hoisting this guy off the throne, which I would think they were like fellow angels. I can't imagine what else they would be, although they looked like they were white suits, I think. The transmission ends. The darkness disappears. The sun comes back out. Everyone's stunned. And Preacher just leaves. He's like, gotta go get Tulip some French fries. Did it seem like did you feel like they might have dropped the ball a little bit with him just walking out? Or did you feel that was correct for his character at this point, considering what had just happened? I'm kind of torn there. I don't know how I feel about that. Dan?
Sorry, I muted. Okay. I liked it. I thought it worked well. I thought there wasn't really anything more to say there.
Okay.
It's understandable since his whole mission was to redeem this town and God was going to do it for him. And the minute that's not there, then there's no reason to even try to redeem this town.
Okay.
He doesn't care. So he's going to leave the town because now he has something else he wants to do. And that's find God and not worry about redeeming this town. So the town is now an afterthought to him. So him just leaving and letting them fall to what they do made sense for for his character at that point.
Okay, I'll buy that. Because then what immediately follows, and they do this really interesting artistic decision, and I suspect Dan might have a comment about it. When there's a certain point as we're watching the screen and we get that still frame for a while where it's really out of focus and blurred, but you can clearly tell that they're trashing the church, that the members of people who are remaining people from the church. Until then, we get to see Quincannon come up and rip down the cross and basically smash it, so that, you know, which ends the scene. So in a weird way, you can say that what eventually does happen to the town is almost like being smacked down by God for what they did. But since God is missing, it really doesn't have anything to do with God. So I don't know if that's really the correct interpretation of it. What did you think of that, the way they did that camera shot? Because that was unique, I would say.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it looked kind of seemed like, you know, the kind of thing they just one of them had been wanting to try for a while, and just it seemed to work pretty well there. So I always like fun stuff like that. If it's not like, you know, if it's not just like Walking Dead trying to be artsy once a season to distract their viewers from the fact that they don't know what the fuck they're doing, but.
Right, and this show has already at least built up enough credit for the last 9 episodes to be artsy when they want to be, because they've given us a lot of really striking or stunning visuals from time to time. Like we said last week, the cinematography and the way they compose things, as well as the use of audio and then the sound on this show, is really top notch. You know, there are a lot of things we may have issues with, but it looks and sounds great.
Yeah, it is. The from the musical choices they make in scenes to how it is, that's one of the things that you, as you said, you can't complain about the show.
Before I move on to the next thing, did you like the sounds that were coming out of the phone to call God? How it sounded kind of
dial-up noises.
The dial-up noises and all the other stuff.
It was 1998 all over again.
I was thinking, wait, is he trying to call Kate or Jason right now? I'm not sure.
1998, that's 2008 for Wisconsin, so.
So, after that, we then get that montage of, I would say, the increasingly sad or disturbing repercussions of the town learning that God is missing. The first one, which we haven't touched on yet, because it's one of those really minor things, but I think we're always going to remember it. Apparently, the mascots, like the past and present mascot for their team, I guess the Savages, were apparently in love with each other.
Yeah.
And they choose to hang themselves from that same tree that we saw all those scout Indians hanging from over like 135 years ago. So that was... It's one of those tragic comic scenes, if that's the right way to put it, I guess. But one of I didn't know how to take this. It was maybe one of the most disturbing things I've seen in some time on any TV show. We get the mother killing her catatonic daughter by suffocating her with the pillow, right? And when you see that, it's so heartbreaking and sad for those few seconds. And then as we pull back, we see who I think is her other son, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Taking a selfie of that. And I went, that might be one of the darkest things I've ever seen.
That was rough. That scene, yeah, it's bad enough, the smothering of the daughter, but the minute the son starts taking a selfie of what's going on, you're like, oh, boy, this town has fallen.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you're like, oh, and let's not forget, I almost did, because I did not have it jotted down, but I just remembered, that we also see that a group of little schoolgirls basically murder that guy that we learned earlier this season was a potential child molester in the school bus. And I have to admit, it took me a moment to realize who that was. I had to go back and like, oh, that's the guy that Jesse talked to who's got an issue with kids and he's a molester, whatever. Oh, Jesus Christ. And again, the fact that the kids all seem kind of like happy with them, pleased with themselves, all these things are kind of underscoring what's about to happen in a couple minutes. And how maybe...
There was a glee with which they did that.
And we would be remiss in talking about the moments we see post the church brouhaha if we didn't mention the stuff with Quincannon. Now, apparently, and I don't know at what point it happens and what story in the comics or something, something they do in the comics where Quincannon has actually fashioned a person or body or whatever out of meat that he then proceeds to have sex with. And the writers of the show decided, we're not going to go that direction. We're going to take some of that concept and make it into something that's more sad and poignant as opposed to disturbing and disgusting. Because he's cradling, you know, I guess the outfit must be from his little Lucy Liu, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And he's cradling what I referred to as in the introduction as his meat baby.
I did like when he asked God, quote unquote God, about his daughter. I kind of, you know, that was effective.
Because it made him human again, even if only for the moment. When you realize that he has a character who's done bizarre socio or psychopathic things, and you know he's twisted, he's fucked up, he enjoys listening to the sounds of cows being slaughtered and whatever, but you have to remember, yeah, this also comes from the fact his entire family was slaughtered in a, you know, cable car accident, you know, and we saw him playing with their intestines, whatever. So yeah, I thought what you in the church scene, that was really effective, as well as him yelling at the preacher to denounce him when Jesse's walking out. Now that I think about that in conjunction with Jesse walking out, maybe that scene does work better for me the more I think about it. So I think I will agree with you guys even more so about that. But but we were wondering, I think Cade, you might have been the one to bring it up last time because I totally blanked on it. We've been wondering all this time, what was the deal with that wall of gauges and meters and buttons, and what was that? What was that control room about? And we find out in this episode it's the control room of the methane electroreactor.
I have a question about that. Yes. Did we ever get a shot of the window showing where all the cow droppings were coming in? Or I don't remember Carl seeing that in any of the prior episodes. I think this is the first time we saw that.
I think this is the first time we've seen that.
Yeah, okay. I don't remember seeing it before.
Yeah, I was just double-checking to make sure I wasn't missing that before.
And I'll tell you, the first time we see that, which is early in the episode, for a moment there, I was like, because I wasn't focusing as well as I should have been, and I just see this big, you know, bubbling pit of whatever, and I'm thinking, oh, this is like a hell thing. And then all of a sudden I realize, oh, wait, that's not hell, it's ew.
Yes, that's 500 feet from my house, exactly.
Oh my god. No, that's not true, right?
No, but okay. 500 yards.
Oh my god.
They're too close for comfort, basically, I think.
So, I guess what and correct me if I'm wrong about this. So apparently, and it goes to what we mentioned before about Quincannon is like, although Miles was the mayor of the town, Quincannon was really the guy in charge, because apparently his meat factory or meat packing place, whatever you want to call it, also powered the town through methane?
Yeah.
Is that how I understand it?
Yep.
Which...
It's a good idea. I mean,
it's... Yeah. Although, when you think about it, if the town's being powered essentially by cow manure and methane, whatever, and then you see those little... what do you call those things? The little exhaust whistle things. There's probably a phrase for it. I can't think what it is right now. Well, we've seen them in previous episodes letting out blasts and whistling. If it's methane, that town must really stink.
Oh, yeah.
Because...
Well, I vaguely remember someone referencing the town stinking at one point. I thought that was a comment that was even made about the town in an earlier episode.
You're probably right. That sounds really familiar to me. So, yeah. Well, anyway... So, and I actually have a question about the scene that we're talking about here. So apparently after some little S&M session with a hooker, the guy who's in charge of running the reactor, the gauges, and keeping an eye on it, whatever, I wasn't clear if he was just insane or dead in the scene. I couldn't be sure.
I think he was dead.
It looked like he might have been dead. Okay, I'm going to say he was dead because that makes the most sense. Because everyone's just in the town has just lost hope. And lost faith, and basically lost everything. It's especially pathetic that the town's last hope is this sad, ball-gagged hooker, who I can't imagine knows what she's doing, and she's just like trying to push every button, whatever, because that needle is buried deep in the red. And I think she even with the ball in her mouth, says something like "uh-oh" or something like that. So what this all culminates in am I wrong to say that the town is blown away by what was essentially like a massive fart? Is that essentially what happened?
A giant methane bomb basically took the town out.
Oh my god.
Like, since it was so, the air was probably filled with the stuff anyway from the point it was pumping it out because of the whole process. When it went up, that took with it. Even just seeing the church go would have been enough to watch the church get blown away and then like all the air get sucked back into the vacuum. That was it was quite an explosive ending for the show.
Everybody had Mexican. So, okay. So Dan, what did you think of that? Cause I know what I thought of it. I have this weird feeling, and we have not talked about this at all. I have this weird suspicion we may be going to the same comparison. I wish I could write it down. We're like on a game show right now, like Tattletales or something. Wow, I just dated myself totally with that reference. I'm curious to hear what you thought of that, if it worked for you, and if it reminded you of anything. So, what was your take on that?
I didn't really dig it that much. It just kind of felt like a, you know, Deus Ex Machina. Thanks, Methina. So I didn't really give it too much thought over other than that.
Methina. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the thing I think that was bothered me in the moment was, okay, so as I understand it, until we hear or see otherwise, you just killed off everybody in the town. You killed off Root and Emily and her kids and Donnie and Odin and all of them. So the problem with that is, so you went through all the trouble of building up all these characters just to wipe them all out. And you did that for a full season. So you know what I thought of.
It sounds vaguely familiar, but it's been a long day.
It's okay. It kind of, and mind you, as I say this, I'm also one of the staunchest defenders of this season. It still remains one of my favorite seasons, even though it does have this similar fundamental flaw to it. I'm thinking about the second season of Lost, where in the second season of Lost, they make a big deal about the other 48. Or the other people, on the other side of the island who crashed in the tail of the plane and yada, yada, yada. But by the time you get to the end of that season, you've pretty much, except for, I believe, again, correct me if I'm wrong, except for one character, you pretty much wipe them all out. And even the one character who did live only makes it to a little bit, only a little ways into season three. So it's like...
Well, besides Bernard, but yeah.
Oh, fuck, I forgot about Bernard. I totally forgot about Bernard. All right, still work, don't care. But you know what? Because the people who have their issues with season two, and I actually love season two, but the people who don't like season two, that's their go-to. That's like, you wasted our time building up the stuff with, you know, Anna Lucia and what's her name, the girl who's going to be her, Libby, and all the other stuff.
Libby.
And then it's like, we're just going to kill them all off. And it's like, well... you went through all this just to introduce... I was just remembering Mr. Echo, who also then disappears early in season three. Oh, yeah, big Lost spoiler. Sorry, guys. Anyway. it's been 10 years. Fuck off.
You should have watched it by now.
Yeah. But I kind of thought that here, and I'm trying to defend it, but when we were talking last week, we had talked about how it felt like this season, what we saw transpire so far, if they had done that in just a few episodes, we think it would have been better than the way they dragged it out for, at that point, 9 episodes. This really brought that home to me, because then you could say, really, you just spent an entire season with all these people, and you just killed them all. And there's something that comes off as like a writer just crumpling a piece of paper and tossing it aside, like, eh. So it's almost like a Deus Machina thing, sort of. There's a different phrase for it. It's just, I'm just going to start over, you know, do over. And everyone just likes these three characters. Okay, we're just going to use those three, and we're going to get rid of pretty much everybody else.
Yeah, I think that they could have definitely benefited from doing a tight six instead of a loose ten. The hooker that gets, you know, doesn't quite save the day.
But it probably wouldn't annoy me as much, you know, or other people. If indeed other people are annoyed about that, I'm sure some people were, whatever. Because wow, you just made Root a good character, and then you killed him. You know, that kind of a thing. You know, oh, I want to see more Jackie Rowley. Nope, too bad, dead. You know, that kind of
thing. That is the thing. That's the problem I think I have with it, is the fact that these characters, by this episode, you're kind of interested to where they're going, and that's when they kill them all off. It's my biggest problem with the season is how this, like, I get where you want to go. You want to clear it all out, Jesse on the road. That maybe work a better first season to have it tell the story to get us there in a different way than doing all of this, almost wasting time on characters that you just kill off in the end. Because it makes no sense.
Here's the question I have for both of you then. And just occurred to me. You could have done this entire season, and as flawed as it was at certain points, whatever. If you don't blow up the town, if you just leave the town devastated with their loss of faith and whatever, because Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy, they're on the road anyway. They're already out of town at the end of the episode. You know that's why they didn't get wiped out in it. So, was there really a need to therefore destroy the town? Because these guys are already on the road, then what was the point of destroying the town other than, you know, tee-hee, look how cruel we can be. We're going to kill all these people. It made that montage of those alternating, disturbing, and heartbreaking moments seem pointless because, you know, 5 minutes later, everyone's dead. Go on, I'm sorry.
One of the things I think that disconnected it for me the most that really made it make no sense is Jesse missing the news report about it in the diner. If he had seen what had happened and it could have some impact on him, like, oh God, this, like basically going, I'm going to blame God for what happened here because he's the one who left and all of this shit's because of him. But him not seeing that, so there's no point of it, then it really serves no purpose at all. That has no function in the show at this point. It was just look what we could do to do it.
Yeah, it didn't really bother me, I guess, as much as it bothered you guys. I mean, it just, you know, for me, it just kind of felt like it worked in the theme of the show. I mean, you know, if these characters are dead, I mean, to be honest, I mean, they're all kind of goofy caricatures, and I didn't really care about any of them anyway. So, I mean, it's almost kind of like, you know, I'm okay with they did that. Just kind of like, it's like if they like burned down Twin Peaks, it would just be like, okay, you know, there goes like, you know, the goofy character dressed like an Indian. There goes this guy. There goes that guy. Whatever. I'll live. I wasn't attached to him.
You know why it bothers me? Because if one of Jesse's, the other part of Jesse's quest is that he's gonna do what he can to find a way to bring Eugene back from hell. So let's assume that somehow, some way, at some point in time, he's able to do that. I'm never going to get the reunion between Eugene and his dad, who had been, you know, caring for him and dealing with him all this time, because dad got wiped out by a giant fart. So that alone, yeah, right, absolutely. There, we don't know for a fact that everyone absolutely is dead. It's conceivable that people could have survived. We don't know that. We're only going by a news report. Oh, by the way, I love the news. If you pay attention and listen to the news reports, they say some really horrible stuff on the news in that town.
Yeah, they do.
When they refer to Eugene in the beginning of as a local freak or something, Eugene. I was like, local disfigured freak or something like that. I was like, what?
Sending Tom Cruise's ashes to space, so that's pretty light and touching.
I thought that was sweet. I was like, oh, nice. So let's finish up here with you know, we got the last 2 moments of the show. The scene in the diner was great. I did really love the scene in the diner for a number of reasons. It even made Cassidy's unending quest to convince people that the Big Lebowski sucks. And I love that they kind of get on him for it. But he makes that really meta comment about the movie, which you don't put that in there unless you're also making a joke about the show. He says something when he says, he's talking about like the end of The Big Lebowski. So if you watch the finale, you've already been spoiled on The Big Lebowski. Plus, that movie came out 15, 20 years ago, so tough shit once again.
I watched it like 2 months ago for the first time.
Just in time, man. When he says, well, so, and I'm not even, I cannot do the Irish accent, I won't do it. So, no, so Steve Buscemi dies, and then they all go back to bowling. So that's it? What was the point of all this then? Which is exactly what we could also say about the season. You know, and what happened to a certain... I think they were really making a little elbow at us with a comment like that.
I figure you just would like that scene because you like to eat French fries for breakfast, don't you? So,
yes.
I could see French fries being your go-to thing after a, the crazy shit that happens.
Well, if there's eggs and bacon involved, yes.
Mm. Oh, fuck eggs.
But Cassie's sum up of you know, sex and drugs and shady characters and bikinis. I'm so in. I love it. Cassie is so good. But this scene between them in the diner, and when we then get the mission statement for next season and for the rest of the show, and it's like a nice pure log line. You know, they're looking for God, and they're either going to help him or they're going to kick his ass. That's. So it's kind of like, you know, the Blues Brothers were on a mission from God. So yeah. Preacher, they're on a mission looking for God or something. I don't know how to phrase it. I didn't write it down. So I really thought that was a great little kicker. And if that had been the end, I thought that would have been a great ending to it. And we get the little reminder about Eugene, that I haven't forgotten about you, that whole thing. But my God, when they're sitting in the car with their sunglasses on and they're just sitting there for a while, and then Cassie kind of goes, what are we waiting for? I love that. And then we got a little bit more. We see that, again, that Seraphine, or Archangel, as I'm going to prefer to call her. I discovered that actress is only 4'9", so she's really tiny.
Wow.
We see her walking around the wreckage of the town, and then she gets a big old hole blown in her, and we see the cowboy, or the character we know from the comics is apparently referred to as the Saint of Killers, has blown her away, and he gravely says, "Preacher," and that's the end of the season. So my final question to both of you, when he shoots these, what are they? Are they, I don't want to say supernatural, godly, angelic characters, do you think they're dead and stay dead as opposed to what normally happens with them?
Yeah, well, the fact that you see
Fiori
without DeBlanc, yeah, he's dead. Like, yeah. When the Saint of Killer kills them, it's a full-on, this is your real death. He's not like a earth weapon or something shooting him. There's some kind of power in his weapons that he can kill even angels.
Maybe that's why he's called the Saint of Killers or something. I don't know.
Right. And well, that's probably why they're having him go after Preacher, because his weapon is probably going to kill Genesis, not so much just kill Preacher, but kill Genesis as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Oh, I'm glad you were able to recuperate and do the podcast, Kate. That's some good shit.
I'm glad I have one insightful thought.
Shut up. do you know what the bummer is about that? I really want to see the two angels together again. It's really sad that they killed him off then. But judging from Fury's face, yeah, and he came back from hell alone, I realized, oh, he killed the other guy. That's a shame. You know, he killed me, essentially, because Dan gets to live. You go by her. Again, hopefully you've heard our previous podcast.
All is right.
That's what I'm talking about. Yes, I know. So... that was pretty much it for the finale and the season as a whole. I think as we talked about last time, there's a lot of issues and flaws with this, but I think overall it was still something that was still compelling viewing
and worth podcasting about too. I've enjoyed it, so I would do it more regularly if we have time next year and feel like it and want to.
Yeah, I would definitely. I'm definitely still going to watch. There was nothing that made me turn the series off. I never want to go back, and the finale definitely makes me want to watch next season.
Right, because when we had spoken before, I think we were in agreement that Cassidy and Tulip were by far the two best characters on the show.
Yeah.
So you got those two, and by the end of this one, now I think Jesse's like, oh, I think I like Jesse now, because Jesse had a lot of great moments in this episode. rewind back to the scene with Carlos and when he's going to hand him the gun. He's going to hand him the gun. No, he's going to shoot him. No, he's going to hand him the gun. The way he even does the little thing with the gun, I said, that's so fucking cool. Jesse, that's a great moment for Jesse.
Yeah.
He's really... This, to me, was my favorite Jesse episode as far as the way he acts in it. Like, this is a character I want to follow on a road trip. I didn't feel that way about him episodes 1-9. So I guess it works in that sense. It just feels like they took an entire season to tell this backstory, and I wonder if that is going to feel like a bit of wasted time to a certain extent, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see how season 2 drags out, because if season 2 comes back and it's totally different how it works, things are moving, if things are going, it's going to be like, it's to the point where I'm thinking, if someone's like, should I watch season 1 to catch up? I'm like, no, just watch the last episode. Don't worry about trying to drag through all 10 episodes to start this next season. Because I think you're just wasting your time.
Yeah, it could end up being one of those. There are several shows out there that if you read or listen to certain critics, or even if you read or listen to me or Dan, we can tell you like, yeah, you may want to skip season 1 or only watch like this episode and that episode and then just move on to the next season. Some shows, they're still trying to find their footing in season 1, or they're not really... They haven't figured things out, I think an example me and Dan think of a lot is Parks and Recreation, and I think I like season 1, but if you're pressed for time and you want to watch the whole show, you could probably skip season 1 because they don't figure out the lead character and how to really use her until season 2. I mean,
season 1 of that show is almost like here's a character with the same name as the season 2 character, but so different. Really,
and they retool it well, but there's still lots of really funny stuff. Chris Pratt's pretty awesome, like in general. But it's only 6 episodes. Watch it.
Yeah,
it's tough because unlike you guys, a lot of people I know or friends of mine they're not as patient, so they'll bail out on something pretty fast. So if I can get them to speed up to something faster, I'll do that. And there's other shows like that. Hell, right now, like The Leftovers, season 2. Amazing, brilliant, perfect, almost perfect. I'm not a fan of season 1. And I could not bring myself to recommend someone to watch all of season 1. I might say, you can watch this episode and that episode.
Yeah.
You can watch 2.5 episodes and then skip to season 2, and you already get the sense. They give you enough previously on to figure out what the hell happened in season
1. Yeah, just look for an episode where Michael Gaston is in the guest cast, watch that episode, skip the rest.
Right. But, I think this one is interesting because although we might have our issues with it, I think we're all really kind of looking forward to what season 2 is going to do, because I feel like that's where the show is really going to take off. And I love the road trip concept. I think that could really benefit the show, and I'm curious to see what they do. And I just love those three being in the car together. If my story is going to have those three together all the time, not splitting them up the way they were this season, I'm in. I'm there.
Agreed.
Yeah, the show is kind of like, it's kind of like methane, where it kind of, it burns at a low temp, so it's kind of a cold burn, but once it gets ignited, it can be pretty volatile. So we just got a view that, they know what they're doing. They had a plan the whole time. Methane.
And yet overall it kind of stinks? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, that's a good analogy. This show is like methane. Yeah.
I'll just say it's more like meth, but I wasn't that addicted to it. No, anyway. All right, I feel like we can kind of close the book on Preacher season 1 and the finale, unless there's anything you guys feel that we've neglected to mention here.
No, I think we covered it all.
Yep. When you say close the book, of course you're talking about the Holy Bible. So
I'm talking about the good book, my man. I'm talking about old school, Old Testament, Wrath of God kind of stuff.
The one and only. Fuck yeah.
All right. Now, normally we would be all giddy at the fact that, we just did a podcast in just a little bit over an hour. We can wrap this up, tie a bow on it. Oh, look, perfectly concise, perfect little podcast. But since we do have a little bit of time here, and Kate is still awake and with us, and Dan is still here as well, which is kind of cool, we thought we might take a few moments to talk about a few other geeky matters, specifically something to do with the recent release of the ultimate cut of Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. I might mention a few other things as well. This might be a few minutes of a hodgepodge. I don't know, but for the superhero geeky among you, I think this could be a fun little conversation we're going to have, and we're going to try to keep it a bit more on the tight side. So don't worry, we're not going to be yakking for another hour. I will pull the plug on this, even if it's pulling a plug on myself if need be. But I kind of definitely wanted to talk about a few things.
And so, what's first?
Well, you know what? Let's go right to the heart of the matter of what we wanted to talk about, which was kind of like the Batman v Superman thing.
Did you watch Man of Steel before you dug into this? Did you rewatch it? You were going to watch Man of Steel?
I did, and I actually was going to preface my Batman v Superman talk with a little bit about Man v Steel. Wow, Man versus Steel, Man of Steel. So yes, I did watch.
Okay, listener. While we try to figure this out, listeners, just go leave us a 5-star iTunes review quick, and then we'll sort this out. So just get click tapping away.
Let me get that out of the way right now. I was not one of the Man of Steel haters out there. I definitely had my issues with it, and I will say that I think Zack Snyder and maybe even David Goyer don't quite get Superman the way they should. That's a bit more evident in Batman v Superman, quite frankly. But rewatching Man of Steel, I became aware that, you know, just a little change here and a little cut there, this really might have been a so much better received movie than it was. One of the base examples that people had issues with before we get to the third act of that movie is the stuff with Jonathan Kent. And I was a person who had huge issues with that, saying, like, because my memory was, Jonathan Kent would never say that. He would never do that. He was like, you know how they make one change, they make one cut in a major scene, it works so much better. Jonathan Kent should not have said maybe. He never, when young Clark says, should I have just let them die? They're referring to saving everybody on the school bus. In the movie, Jonathan Kent said, maybe. And I was like, wait, what? Whoa, no. Jonathan Kent, much less any other normal, rational-minded father or human being, would never say that. He should have said, of course not, but you have to be careful. You know, whatever. Then no one has an issue with that scene. Him saying maybe, him telling his son that, yeah, maybe you should have let everybody die just to keep your secret safe because of how people are going to react to you, was nothing any version of Jonathan Kent, in my memory, would have ever said, much less any father would have said. It was just weird.
It undercut the raising of Superman. It undercut the parents who supposedly made him this good all-American boy for his father to say something like that.
And it made him harder to care about, too, when the character, spoiler alert, when the character gets killed by the fallout from the, he was killed by a methane tornado explosion fallout, so.
This is built up from the audience reacting to the earlier scene. And even that scene, which, again, is the 1-2 punch of why we don't like that stuff, that's like the punch number two there. It's like, what? I don't mind Jonathan Kent like trying to wave him off, but he still should have tried. And maybe if he had rushed and then grabbed him, but only like the shirt ripped and he gets ripped away from what, something like that could have made that work better. And then he could just regret that he shouldn't have hesitated, that he should have just done it without whatever. But the way it plays is kind of, well, you know, it's still kind of stupid. Other than that, I really like Man of Steel. Guess what, guys? I watched it. He does smile a bunch of times. Is he grinning ear to ear the way Christopher Reeve would from time to time? No, but he does smirk a lot. He does have a few moments of levity. Should there have been more? Yes. Does that bother me? No. When he tells Lois, no, you should step back a little bit further before he takes off, that's kind of funny. So I definitely enjoyed it more than I remembered, and it was kind of interesting to watch that just before getting ready for the ultimate, now the ultimate cut of Batman v Superman. And personal spoiler, I was insane, at least for half the movie, until I said I can't do this anymore. I was literally watching like 10 to 15 minute segments of the ultimate cut then I would stop, go back, and watch the same, roughly the same segment in the theatrical cut to try to figure out what was different. Then about an hour and change into the movie, I realized, Scott, you may claim or act like you're some big smarty on the Facebook, whatever, but you're a fucking moron, because there are probably any number of websites that have an entire breakdown of all the differences, and I went and looked like, oh, here's one. It's got everything here. What the fuck is wrong with me? So at that point, I said, okay, I was making a now three-hour movie 6 hours. I'm going to watch it as a regular movie now. So from about an hour and 15 minutes on, I watched it just as the ultimate cut. And then I went back afterwards and I noticed what the difference. I mean, I can kind of remember what the differences were, but everyone's telling you come across something, you're like, was that in the original or not? I don't remember that. Like, there was one big thing which I didn't remember in the movie, and I said, oh, they must have added that. That's amazing. And I went back and, like, oh, they didn't add that? I just didn't remember that? Wow.
Which scene was that?
Oh, I didn't remember a lot of the conversation between Wonder Woman, Batman, and Superman. Just before the whole, I thought she was with you, whatever. I thought that little, I thought she was with you, happens a lot faster. I forgot they have a whole back and forth, which then makes that make more sense. I don't know why I just forgot that. Anyway, so I watched that, and Cade, as I understand it, you watched it also. I guess you probably actually went out and bought your copy, whereas mine was donated to me from a listener.
My father bought it from my brother, and they both hadn't seen it, so we watched it, so I didn't have to pay for it.
Excellent. Okay, so what was your feeling about it? And then, because I think for a change, we are not on the same page, so I'm kind of curious to hear what your reaction was to it.
And did you like Man of Steel? Like, generally,
I liked Man of Steel.
Okay.
All right.
I did not like Batman vs. Superman, the regular edition. So when I went into this, we watched the Ultimate, I'm like, okay, I'll give it a shot, because I heard they added stuff back in. And while I think Scott using the term the ultimate cut of this is the part that interests me the most, while the stuff they added in definitely made things flow better, it made the story, it fleshed it out more, it made more sense. My still problem was is the things I hated before, I hated even more now. They stuck out even more to me. Like, the dreams, I hated the dream sequences in the original version. I hated them even more here because they felt even more unnecessary. You had enough motivation for Bruce Wayne to do what he wanted to do. You didn't need those. So instead of a 2.5-hour movie I hated, I had a 3-hour movie I hated where there were parts I liked more, but hated those parts I hated before even more, because I'm like, you really should have, like, when you added, you should have snipped some parts out. Cut the movie down, remove some unnecessary things that just, especially the flash dream, serves no purpose in that film. And this one underscored it even more. I hated that part.
Wow. Oh, weird.
Cut that out. Ooh. Remove that from it.
Wow.
Just add the parts in to tell a tighter story. This movie was too long, and to make it longer didn't do it any good.
Interesting.
Well, you're definitely not sleepy anymore, motherfucker.
Okay. Yeah, I
should have talked about this first.
No, then you'd be all tired now.
No, I wouldn't want to talk about Preacher. I would have worn myself out. It wasn't just my reaction. I'm watching it with my dad and my brother, and these are two guys who enjoy movies. They don't sit there and get real critical like I will with a movie. They just generally enjoy watching a movie, and if there's moments where I'm looking over and they're just like, what the hell's going on? I'm confused. Like the dream sequences, that took them out of the movies. Like, they liked when Superman and Batman were fighting. They were into that. That played through. But any time I would look over and just see they seemed confused, I'm like, this is probably removed from the movie, and it would have made it a better film. That I'm not saying it should have been done so the masses would have loved it, but it could have helped the movie be a better movie in general to remove things that most people found confusing.
Wow, okay. Interesting. All right. Okay, I assume the main dream sequence you're referring to, although I'm hesitant to call it a dream because I don't think it's a dream, is the whole apocalyptic vision of the future part. Is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Okay. I can't really agree with you to a certain extent. I'll admit that in terms of the storytelling of this movie, that kind of does feel like it was pushed in you know, it's, well, this is what a future movie is going to be about, so we're going to put it in here now, which is a problem with this movie entirely as far as just trying to put too many things in. Does that mean I don't like that sequence? Or I was not, you know, kind of like, you know, found it kind of amazing and just like, you know, my jaw was like, wait, what's going on here? And I could figure out what was going on there, you know, pretty much. No, I would not have necessarily, at this point, once it's in the movie, I wasn't going to say, oh, they should remove that. I don't have a, when I did the podcast with Pat, and we spent all that time talking about our issues with the movie, and I think that podcast, if you want to go back and listen to it, I think about 80-85% of that podcast is us talking about our problems with it, and maybe 15% is positive. I don't recall if either of us had a major problem with that, other than the fact, okay, not everyone is going to know that that's telling us that Dark Side is coming. I don't fucking care. It doesn't matter. Because really, all it's telling us that something bad is going to happen. And this is, they put that in here. Does it feel like it's the right point in that movie for that? Probably not. It plays a little weird. And I think the confusing thing is, wait, was that a dream or not? Was that a vision or not? Is that the Flash? If that's the Flash, does he have the ability to do this or not? That is the confusing element of it. I agree with that. It's not inserted in the movie very well. There's a certain weird clumsiness to it that makes it confusing. But the actual vision itself is so striking and so interesting and makes me wonder about it. And the fact that it wasn't until I watched the ultimate cut, and again, this is not something that was added to it, I realized there's a running line in that movie that's used in that apocalyptic vision, and to great effect, in fact. Because there's a line that Jonathan Kent says, and then Clark or Superman says, and they refer to their, whether it be Martha or Lois, and they keep referring to it as being their world. And Superman says that in the apocalyptic vision before he presumably rips out Batman's heart, or that's what it looks like is about to happen, because he's blaming her for her death, and he says, she was my world, and you took her from me. So, and I don't even think I realized, or I noticed that when I watched the movie in the theater. It's like, oh, that's a recurrent theme throughout this story. The writers did that there. I didn't notice that. So that is... I will agree with the other stuff. I never understood the thing of a Bruce going to the graveside of Martha and the bat creature coming out of the wall, whoever the fuck that was. That was, and I didn't understand that.
I'll be honest, of the ones, the dreams that I would say I could accept it, I'm okay with it in a movie if it was cut in and worked better. That's one that I would be okay with. Because that does play into the reference to him being a god and could make the world bow to him. You can see it. The Flash ones is the one I really, really hate. That had served no purpose in the film. But that one, I agree. If it was handled better and they could work it into the film a lot smoother, I wouldn't have had so much of an issue with that one.
Okay, well, let's just get back to the film overall, because I don't want to get too hung up on the one scene, because that's just about whether that scene should have been cut or not. One of the things about the ultimate cut I should make clear to people is they don't just add in scenes. It's not purely, oh, we've added a half an hour more material. They do something else in the ultimate cut, which is I found very interesting. They change the order of scenes. They rearrange the storytelling. And speaking as a, and I'm going to use air quotes on myself here, writer, and this is one of the things I did go back and watch how they did it in the original. I thought they did a better job of rejiggering the order of certain scenes in the ultimate cut as opposed to what they do in the original. Can I actually say something what I thought was positive? Because we actually haven't said one thing I said was positive about the ultimate cut, other than the fact I actually do like it better than the original. One of my biggest issue, or one of my three biggest issues with Batman v Superman, was Lex Luthor. What is he doing? What are his motivations? What is his connection to everything? What's the deal with the stuff in Africa? What's the deal with the guy blowing up his wheelchair? All the Luthor connected stuff never felt like it was cohesive or even made a lot of sense. Even when you got to the very end of why he was motivated to do this, and I think that you couple that with Jesse Eisenberg's manic, whatever, performance, one of the things that many people didn't like about the movie was the Lex Luthor stuff. I felt by fleshing out that story, everything from the Nairobi, Africa stuff to other things that Luthor does, all the way up to the end, really made the Luthor, for me, made the Luthor stuff work so much better. I saw the progression of what he did and why he was doing it, which I didn't get either of the times I saw it in the theater. So I think that was a huge good thing, a benefit of the Ultimate Cut.
And that's one thing I said. It made the story far more cohesive in how it flowed, especially with Lex. Instead of all these random things that he may have been playing, you actually see that he was playing a long game. He was doing things here and there, moving them into place to where he wanted them to be. And in the other movie, it was kind of like, is that what he was doing? Here, you realize Lex placed them into this position. He got these two where he wants them to do to help him achieve what it is he's going to achieve. And I will say that is one of the better parts of the movie. And I don't want to say I do like this better than the original cut. I'm just saying I hated the parts I hated even more in this one.
Right. Oh, but, yeah. Oh, I'm not giving the movie a pass. there are still...
Yeah, no, it is definitely better because of... There are certain things that they fleshed out and made more prominent in how they worked that made things make a lot more sense. I can agree to that.
And what's interesting? I'll even go back to something you said before, which would be the one way I could get on board with you. If, say, they cut out some of these dream things. Now, again, I like the apocalyptic vision thing. It's still to this... how do I knock the thing that's probably one of the two most striking and memorable things about the movie overall? It's a little weird. But in terms of the story they're telling, if you don't have that, and you don't have the stupid creature coming out of the crypt, whatever the fuck that was supposed to be, which just was weird, and quite frankly, even if you decided not to have the other weird one, which we sometimes forget, Clark running into the ghost of his dad, up in the mountains, which...
Yeah.
I was able to stomach more this time around. But let's say you cut all those things out. And let's say you also found a less dopey, clunky way to introduce the other Justice League potential Justice League characters. Then let's just click on these icons. Which, when even watching it a third time, that still plays a little dumb. I actually wish they hadn't done that at all. It should have just been Wonder Woman's picture, and that was it. It shouldn't have been the other things, which just played as fanboy appreciation, and even they had their problems with it. They shouldn't have bothered with it. But if you cut all that shit out, and look, I'm actually going to agree with you, and then you save that amount of time, then you could have pushed some of this other stuff in there, and then maybe the movie works better as a movie. You know what? Why not introduce Jimmy Olsen's character if you're going to put him in there? That was, because he's never introduced in the cut that we saw in the theater. At least here, we see Lois Lane meeting him. I'm Jimmy Olsen. We realize she's never met him before. We get a story. Why? So then we know why he's not really a photographer. He's actually a CIA plant. Where the fuck he's supposed to be? But it makes sense in the Ultimate Cut. But in the original version, we're like, it wasn't until we were watching the cut, I was like, wait, that was Jimmy Olsen? What? And they also...
I'm going to ask you guys a question. And now you guys both know I'm not a fan of the original Superman movies at all. They just don't work for me. And we're not gonna go into
forever.
I've seen the first two, and if I didn't like those, I sure as fuck wasn't watching 3 and 4. But I liked Man of Steel a lot. So based on that knowledge of what works for me, is this movie worth watching for me, or is it kind of can I just go watch fucking Justice League and just not bother with this at all? What?
Ooh.
Kind of like Cade was saying about the first 9 episodes of Preacher. You guys have a different take on this, different take of the film. It's
So you didn't get around to seeing Batman v Superman? Is that?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Oh, okay. Okay.
When everybody hated it in the theater, and I was just kind of okay going into it in the first place. But now that I've heard, some people say that the extended divisions, it's better.
You know what? If it's watching it at home, I would say, and plus your expectations are already lowered to a point where you'd probably. It's like me watching Fantastic Four a few weeks ago.
Oh God! Wow.
It was on HBO. I didn't have to pay for it. It was there.
Okay, that's fair.
I didn't buy it. I didn't rent it. And for at least 15, 18 minutes, I was like, oh, I actually kind of like this. And then it kind of whatever. And then it's frustrating because it's like, oh, you know what? There could have been a good movie here. And some of the issues people had with the movie before it ever came out are kind of bullshit. But yeah, then it sucks. But I'm going to say if you liked Man of Steel, it's and you're going into this with lowered expectations anyway, I would say I'd watch it. Hell, I mean, get to see Wonder Woman on screen for the first time ever. That's kind of worthwhile.
And I tend to like Jesse Eisenberg too. So whatever he's doing, I would say watch it.
I would say still watch it because, like Scott said, there's Wonder Woman.
There's some good stuff in there, you know.
I liked. I can't remember his name.
Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck as Batman. I liked him as Bruce Wayne. I like the bits where he's in the movie.
Yeah.
Superman may be one of the weakest parts of the film.
But better in the ultimate cut.
Better in the ultimate cut. He definitely is. He comes off a lot better in that version.
Actually, you know what's better in the ultimate cut with him? The Clark Kent stuff. Because we get we get a whole lot more Clark Kent stuff in the ultimate cut of him finding out about Batman and going to Gotham and all that stuff, which is not in the original. I was like, I understand the time factor, but I'm like, oh, they really Henry Cavill gets to play Clark Kent in this fucking ultimate cut version. We hardly saw any of that in the
right. He gets to the call with his mom. Was that in the original? I don't recall that being in the original.
It wasn't in the original.
That was a good scene. It was a good scene with his mother. So yeah, I would say if you're going to watch it, watch the Ultimate Edition though. Don't watch the regular because that movie is still garbage. Yeah.
So they kind of like let the Superman character be like a little bit more humanized instead of like doubling down on like the god shit that they were ramming down our throats in the trailers and stuff.
Yeah, but it's more evident in the Ultimate Cut than it is in the theatrical cut. Like there's a scene in the theatrical cut which bothered me and I think bothered a lot of people, I'm sure Kate as well, when after, you know, there's this gigantic explosion which presumably wipes out everybody, and in the theatrical cut Superman's just standing there looking kind of like, you know, God or something, and then and that's it, then he leaves, that's it, but at least in the theatrical cut we do see like all these different people on the steps of the Capitol and they're being tended to and him coming down with a person in his arms. So at least you get the impression he was zipping around trying to help people or save people before he leaves. Before it's like what the hell,
he's just gone and then mopes about it later.
Oh, and by the way, they in the ultimate cut we get an explanation of why he wouldn't catch on to
the
bomb.
Yes, that was the thing that really made me, that one of the things that was super happy about is like, thank you for not making him just seem like an aloof idiot, that there was something to prevent him. Even if he wanted to see it, he wouldn't have been able to see it.
Yeah, there's things like that I appreciate it and I think helped it. Again, is it still, do I still have a lot of problems with it? Oh, of course. You still have everything from, The car chase is still incredibly pointless and doesn't make any sense.
Oh my god, yeah.
Only because there's no need for it, and you realize this is only here so we get a car chase.
And to set up him meeting Superman.
Yeah.
In the worst way possible.
Which also doesn't, again, doesn't make any sense. Like, the next time your light's up in the sky, don't answer. It's like, but it's the police who are summoning him with the light, so therefore, though, how is he a criminal if they're, I don't understand. That still doesn't make any sense. To this day, we're criminals too. Like, no, but the police are the one contacting you to help, so you're not a criminal. Shut up. Makes no sense. But at least some of the other stuff does. Yeah. The Martha moment is still dumb. It's still
talk about Deus Ex Martha right there.
Oh, boy. That scene could have, I just feel, I know it's cute that they both have the same name, but I feel the scene still could have worked, save my mother, and you didn't need the Martha shit. To make it silly, and it just would have worked from a purely emotional point. But the whole
because it would that's enough to humanize him. Save my mother.
Yeah,
like Bruce would. That would be enough for Batman to go to stop, to realize someone's mother.
And
is
no
trouble.
One would have been making fun of that. But no. The whole Martha thing, and it's like, why did you say that name? Why? It's like, oh, And when you watch it again, you realize how many times they get the name. We're made aware of her name being Martha. Just so in case anyone forgets, his mom's name is Martha. We're gonna see it here. Just so don't forget that, because that's gonna play a part later. It's like, no, it didn't have to. But I am excited for the Justice League. So. Trailer for that was pretty cool.
Yeah, Justice League looks good. So yeah, I would watch the Ultimate Edition, Dan. Definitely.
Okay.
All right. I would talk about more, but we're already kind of running a little bit long, so I'm going to compartmentalize any other geeky talk I had in mind. You know, like I saw the Killing Joke or all the trailers we saw from Comic-Con. Maybe we'll talk about them in another podcast. Maybe we won't talk about them at all. You guys have all seen them. Who the fuck cares? But that was a pretty fun podcast. You guys enjoy all that shit we just talked about?
That was a fun one. I did enjoy that.
Good times. Good times here at the STVD podcast.
So if you folks out there enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as the three of us enjoyed delivering it to you with our dulcet tones, you might enjoy our Facebook page. That's the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Like the page, join the page, and join the conversation. As Dan mentioned before, you can also find us on iTunes. We do appreciate all the ratings and reviews we can get. I think we've only gotten one additional one all fucking year, so come on, people. But you can also subscribe to our feed there as well. And lastly, you can also follow us on Twitter. The handle we have there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. That's it for this evening. I believe we do have another podcast that we will be releasing soon, which will be either really great or really a horrible experiment gone wrong. I'll leave it to you guys out there to listen to it to make that decision for us. And I think Dan and I have an idea that we've hatched that we may get around to doing in a few weeks, kind of a weird little quid pro quo TV show kind of thing between the two of us. Do we mention what that's about, or should we just keep that a secret for now?
It's up to you.
Ooh, secrets, but I know the secret, so I don't care.
I feel like it might have been mentioned on the Facebook page anyway, so it might not be important. Well, basically, I think Dan and I have committed to watching a show that the other has recommended to each other countless times before. And so I've finally started watching Deep Space Nine via Netflix, and I believe Dan has finally dived into the show Oz. So I think we may try to do a podcast where we talk about each other's favorite or among our favorite TV shows. Because I know Oz is pretty much one of my all-time favorite TV shows. And I think Deep Space Nine is likewise for you, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we'll try to knock out maybe we can get through the first season of each other's shows, which is much easier for me than you.
Yes. But but you're running around and hiking.
Yeah.
And mountain climbing and whatever the heck you do, so you don't have time to be sitting there binging. So so we will be doing that eventually as well. But until we release these other podcasts, that'll be it for us. So unless you guys have any final thoughts.
Thanks for joining us again, Cade.
Thanks for having me, guys. I liked our little preacher podcast we did. This was a nice little fun little side podcast, because I don't know if I've done anything other besides the Geekcast besides this and Stranger Things at this point. I know you've had Jason on, but as far as me, this might be the only side ones I've ever done.
That might be true. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for pointing out how we have neglected you. So thanks for that.
Well, I got to do something, right?
But it's okay, because we've had Jason on, but we actually like Cade, so
that's true. Yeah.
Happy birthday, Jason. Fuck
yeah.
You.
Yeah, happy birthday. Hope you enjoyed that. Oh, by the way, forget Jason. If you guys out there, if you've watched Stranger Things and you haven't listened to that podcast that Kate just made a reference to,
please go listen to that.
Stop listening to this one right now. Actually, listen to this one for whatever the last song is we're going to play. And then, immediately, go listen to the Stranger Things podcast. That's one of the few podcasts I've done that I'm really kind of proud of, not because we don't do a good job normally, it's just I really like Stranger Things, and I feel like we really cover a lot of territory with that one, and it's kind of a fun companion piece to that TV show, which is definitely going to be making my best of list when we get around to that at the end of this year.
That podcast, I was on it, and I've still listened to it twice since then.
I haven't done that. I've listened to it once. Okay, so with all that said, and yes, as Dan said, thank you, Kate, and thank you, Dan, of course.
Dan, nice having you.
And especially for your upcoming audio editing prowess that you'll be doing shortly. Beyond that, good night to everybody out there.
Good night.
Seattle, we love you.
For one heart to carry on. You're way on top now. Since you left me, you're always laughing way down at me. But watch out now, I'm gonna get there. Together for just a little while, and then I'm gonna put you way down here, and you'll start crying 96 tears. Comes up, I'll be on top. You be right down there, looking up. And I might wave, come up here, but I don't see you waving now. I'm way down here, wondering how I'm gonna get to you, but I know now. I'll just cry.